I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, a conversation with the activist, community organizer, and former Baltimore mayoral candidate, DeRay McKesson, one of the most recognizable voices in the modern movement for racial equality and social justice. In 2014, in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri, an African-American teenager, Michael Brown Jr., was killed by a white police officer, Darren Wilson. Protests there galvanized a new generation of activists. In his book, On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope, DeRay McKesson recounts his experience on the front lines of protest in Ferguson, in Baltimore, and elsewhere, amid an unprecedented technological evolution that has redefined a new era of American civil rights. DeRay McKesson joins me for the hour when Midday gets underway, right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. In his new book, the activist and organizer DeRay McKesson writes that faith is the belief that certain outcomes will happen, and hope the belief that certain outcomes can happen. He writes compellingly about faith, hope, and the work of social justice in this new era of civil rights activism, shaped by the Black Lives Matter movement and operating in a social media environment that has dramatically altered the capacity of organizers to direct protest in ways that only a few years ago were unimaginable. The book is called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. We'll take your calls and comments a little later. We are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page. Good to see you, DeRay.
It's so good to be back.
So I'm taken by this book on many levels. But I want you to expand a little bit on something you say in the first chapter, where you talk about how Black and other marginalized people are asked to carry the burden of hope. And it almost feels compulsory for marginalized people to carry the burden of hope. Talk a little bit about that.
You know, I think about hope as a belief that our tomorrows can be better than our today. So when we say the system is broken and people say, oh no, it was designed to be like that, my takeaway from that is that it was designed, that people made this up, and because people made it up, we can make something better. So when I think about the people, the work of marginalized people, poor people, it's like, we know that, like, this is not the best version of the world that exists. And, like, that's part of our call and our message, that we've always overcome things that were meant to kill us, and we're still here. So I think about hope not as magic, but hope as work, which is, like, the core part of the book. I think that we went through this period, especially in the last 4 years, where it was cool to sort of be hopeless, where hopelessness was sort of like a marker of honesty and true critique. And you know, I think that that just, like, is a false, that's a false world to live in, that the reason that people are on the street, the reason that people are protesting at the Senate office and calling people and running for office is because they know that this is not the best version of the world. And we think about things like white supremacy, like God didn't create Earth, man, and white supremacy, you know, that, like, people made this up.
And so is there a general case for hope that's really that overrides this feeling of hopelessness that so many people do, in fact, share?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's a reminder that it's not even that change comes slowly, but that the work that we're engaged in, one of the biggest differences between the right and the left is that the right is always engaged in the work of nostalgia. It's repackaging really old messages with new language. So we've heard Law and Order 10 million times. We've seen people in cages before. We've seen this call that, like, people don't really deserve assistance from the government. Like, those things aren't new. We've survived that before. On the left, we're always engaged in the most intense make-believe. We're always trying to tell a story about a world that nobody's ever seen before, but that we think is possible. And that's just hard. So how do we tell a story about universal healthcare? It's like, you've never seen that before. Like, that is about, that literally is us telling a story about something you've never seen. And we think about our city. How do we tell a story about a city where there's no crime and no addiction? You've never seen that before. So telling stories and organizing for a world that nobody's seen before, but we know is possible, is just hard work. So when I think about the work of hope, it is this acknowledgement that, like, something better is out there that we work for and we fight in the absence of seeing it, because we know it's possible, and that we know that it doesn't come easily and that it doesn't just come on its own. So when King says that the arc bends towards justice, I'm reminded that it bends because people bend it.
And when you talk about the hopelessness that has, you know, certainly imbued, you know, so many even movements. I mean, even movements for change, you know, as you say, sort of very, very forcefully acknowledge the difficulty in making that change. But you talk about accepting trauma as a condition of the world is to surrender our imagination. Do you think that there's still a whole lot of acceptance of trauma going on? I mean, is that still a hurdle that needs to be overcome before more work, better work can be done to change it?
Yeah, and I write that not blaming people, right? Like, I'm always mindful not to blame people for being victims of a system or being implicated in that system. But what I will say is that especially people who grew up in marginalized communities, one of the conditions of growing up in a marginalized community is that you grew up on the margin, right? And on the margin, you're often unheard and unseen, and like that's a condition of being marginalized. Another condition, though, is that you learn the constraints really well. So I think about like growing up without a lot of money, you know how far a dollar can stretch because like you have to understand that constraint. Growing up without a lot of toys, you understand how to go outside and still have a lot of joy with just your feet and your hands, right? Like, or like how to jump rope with the phone lines, right? Like you learn the constraints really well. One of the hard things is that as we get older, is that some people, some of us, literally, we never lose that laser light focus on the constraints. The constraints are the only way that we start to think about the world. And part of the work that we have to do is like, if we're going to build something we've never seen before, we can't do that only looking at the constraints. We got to like look beyond the constraints. So when I think about this idea of accepting the trauma, it is like, that's another way of saying like, you only see the constraints in the world. So some of what we have to do is like, ignore the constraints a little bit so that we can imagine something better. So if you think about the school system here in Baltimore, there are people who literally have never been in a school with like natural light. They've never been in a school where like there is heating and air conditioning. Like you've just never seen it before. So your idea of what a school looks like is like a school without resources, right? But part of it is like you might not even fight for a school with a lot of resources because you've literally never seen it before. So we have to suspend some of that belief to put people in a place where they can actually like ask the big ask.
So it is important for people to be able to imagine what it is folks are working for. And you also point out right at the top of your book that you have to name it. And I think probably you among just a few others have done a lot to create a language around what change can be, to create the rhetoric that people didn't have before to talk about what's needed moving forward. The importance of language, the importance of the rhetoric that we're hearing, where do you think that's headed?
Yeah, I think that language is a big part of it. You think about when we talk about justice and accountability, for instance, is that accountability is what happens after the trauma. Justice is the fact that people should never have to experience a trauma in the first place. We even think about people use language like third world country. It's like, no, there's one world, right? Like there might be a developing country, but there's actually one world. And I'm always mindful of the way that language is one of the first ways that power is distributed and redistributed. The other thing is like, how do we just tell the truth like really plainly? So, you know, I interviewed Ocasio-Cortez on the podcast and people call her like a socialist and they're like, she has all these radical ideas. And it's like,
she's the young woman that won the primary unexpectedly in the Bronx and Queens.
Huh? And it's like, Ocasio-Cortez believes that every kid should have breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And like that to me doesn't seem like a wild idea, right? She believes that everybody should have a high quality doctor and a chance to see that doctor whenever they are sick or feel like they might be sick. That to me isn't a wild idea. And we should start like pushing people on those things so that they stop labeling the things that we believe as so far-fetched. And, you know, even when I think about social welfare programs, I'm no longer trying to convince people about the importance of food stamps as like in the world. I'm asking people now, like, what does a 4-year-old have to do to earn dinner? Like, what does a 7-year-old have to do to be worthy of a place to sleep, right? Like, I want the other person to have to do some work, and that is a work of language. Like, how do we craft the questions and the experiences in a way that makes sense to people?
When it comes to earning, you talk about people of color deemed as high need to earn, but low deserve, low on the deserving scale, while white people are high on the deserving scale and low need to earn. Talk about what that rhetoric refers to, the need to earn and deserving.
Yeah, it's literally what I just said about the, like, I don't know what you know, when people talk about social welfare programs, the underbelly of it, you think about the school system in Baltimore, it's like, what is the case for there being heaters in every school? Like what could I possibly say to you or show you that makes you think finally these kids are worthy of like sitting in a building that like is heated? Or like, what do they have to do to like earn it, like earn like an air conditioner. I don't know.
But aren't those budgetary decisions made not in a vacuum? They're made in the panoply of all the other things that the city or the state needs to spend money on. So perhaps people aren't saying the kids don't deserve, the kids haven't earned the right to a heater in the school, but the resources are limited and it's going to take time, et cetera. I mean, we've heard the political rhetoric around why, like, it hasn't happened immediately.
That's the rhetoric, but that's just not the reality. So we know that budgets are moral documents, and they are a recognition of, like, where people's values lie. So you see Hogan at once sort of slamming the school system while there's a surplus at the state, right? So it's not a lack of resources, actually. So you think about all that work that we did. I was a chief human capital in the school system not too long ago, the youngest chief in the history of the district. And I think about all the work Dr. Santelices did and that we all did to fight for funding. And everybody's like, there's no money. And it's like, just kidding, everybody. There's a surplus at the state level that, like, Hogan literally just doesn't believe inequity. So we think about the difference between equality and equity, that equality is everybody gets the same thing. Equity is that people get what they need and deserve. And we just know, we know from national data that it costs more to educate kids in poverty and kids with special needs. And Hogan's line is that, like, oh, they already get a lot of money. It's like, well, it actually just costs more to educate kids who come from this background, no fault of their own. And, like, you are unwilling to acknowledge that difference. And, like, that is just not, that is, race is a, there's no way to think about the situation without thinking about race. And it does come down to this, like, you know, kids in other counties, in Montgomery County, aren't, nobody's having a conversation about, like, should there be heaters in school? That's like a wild notion. That will politically be untenable. But here in the city, it's sort of like, oh, well, a lot of crime, a lot of drugs, like, they should be happy with what they got. And it's like, no, no, our kids actually deserve something much better than this. And, like, if we don't fight for it because we know they deserve it, we'll never get it.
When it comes to, for example, the governor's apparent distrust of school administrators in general, I mean, you, as you mentioned, you work for the school system here on North Avenue for a while. The governor wants to support, or wants to create, has by executive order created an office of, inspector general oversight of the school systems. It doesn't appear that he trusts the folks running the school system in the city or Baltimore County or Prince George's County or some other counties even on the Eastern Shore. What's your take on where that's premised? Where does that distrust come from? And having been inside the school system, is it your take that that distrust is merited to any degree?
I think that it's not actually distrust. I think that that's the public narrative. I think that the real motive is control. And he knows that people feel really strongly about what happens to their kids. So if he can have, like, more control over school systems, I think that that is what he wants, because, you know, teachers have a lot of sway, and the public education remains one of the biggest issues in the state because it is so, so good in some places and so poor in other places. You know, one of the real hard parts about the school system here in Baltimore is that because it has two bosses, the school district can never take real strong public stand. So Dr. Santelices' stand around the funding was probably the single biggest thing we've seen a superintendent do. Dr. Alonzo did a big public push to renovate all the buildings with the 21st Century Plan. But in terms of, like, some of the way, you know, like, because the money comes from the state and the city, the school system has this fine act to sort of toe around, like, not criticizing either, because the thought of losing money is just so wild to what'll happen to kids. But I wish that, like, the school system could come out and just say, like, that's just wrong. Like, you're wrong, right? That, like, you shouldn't be able to do this. It's not fair to our kids. And, you know, the reality is that there are all these, not until Dr. Santelices announced the $100 million funding gap, did the Baltimore politicians start to fight publicly for funding, right? It's like, you guys have been here for decades and you knew the school system was underfunded, but it only became an issue that you were willing to yell about in public when, like, she went out and said that this is a big deal. And it's like, who are the politicians who fight for these things every single day just because it's the right thing to do? It's like Bill Ferguson did it. He came from the school system, so he did it often. But, like, I think about all these other city council people who just sort of, like, watched it happen. All the state senators, state delegates who just watched it happen. And then when there's a big crisis, they're like, oh my goodness, we got to do something about it. I think about that too with the police department. You think about how many of these people were in office when you were hearing reports, I was hearing reports of the jump out squads. You were hearing that the police are planning things. And, like, the wildest thing about the Gun Trace Task Force being indicted is not only that they got indicted and not that, like, they got convicted. Like, that is wild in and of itself. But the even scarier thing is that there's no mechanism in the city of Baltimore that caught it. There wasn't, like, a supervisor. There wasn't internal affairs. There wasn't an inspector general. It wasn't HR. It wasn't a city council hearing. Like, It's a, you know that it's a small city. You know, like at the end of the day,
somebody had to know.
Somebody, like
more than one somebody.
Yes, and yeah. Like you, I just will not believe that you've been on the city council for 20 years and you never heard of this. And, it, and you think about all the random things that the city council has hearings about. I didn't get a hearing about this. You know, like that is wild.
Is this just like shiny object syndrome? In other words, they just, you know, glom on to whatever the story du jour is. And if the story doesn't have to be police or the schools in any given week, they're running like, you know, they're just looking for the latest headline to comment on.
Yeah, and
it's that lack of consistency, that lack of talking about the school system even when it's not in the headlines.
Yeah, and it's like it's people more in love with the rhetoric than the work, right? So like it's a great campaign speech, it's great lip service, but like, will you be willing to put everything on the line because it's the right thing to do? I think that we've seen time and time again, no. So you even think about the mayor's recent call. I'm actually more shocked by this. I don't know if you've covered this already in the show. The mayor's recent call for state troopers to patrol the streets of Baltimore. Like, did you see that press conference? That is the fact that people aren't like outraged by that is wild to me. Like, yes, we have a crime problem. We know that some things actually don't work. And state troopers are one of those things that like, that is literally the same thing as Trump saying the National Guard should police the streets of Chicago. It's the same. That's it. And like the fact that the city council, the fact that there are state delegates just being like, you know what? They're going to be silent when the mayor calls for state troopers to be on the streets. It's like in Baltimore, we have crimes of addiction and crimes of poverty are the majority of the crimes that we have. We actually know what to do with crime and poverty, addiction and poverty. It's like if there was an aggressive plan around treatment centers, like that would be interesting, right? Like we're not doing that. If there was some interesting plan around like how do we do job placement that is not just getting, you know, when this current administration in the city talks about jobs, it's like this idea that everybody just needs a job. And it's like, no, people need like a career path. So if you give somebody a job that they make $8 an hour for the rest of their life, that actually isn't a, like you are doing negligible long-term work. Yes, it's better in the moment, but that actually isn't setting up a 22-year-old mom of two for like a life where they can make a set of real choices, right? And like, we don't have that. And what always makes me sad about the city is that it's not a lack of resources, not a lack of, I mean, there is a lack of structural resources, but we have enough here to start. It's not a lack of people. It is certainly the lack of a plan.
We'll come back and talk more about what some of those plans should include. The book is called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. We'll have more with DeRay McKesson when Midday returns after a quick break. We'll start taking your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to drop us a tweet @MiddayWIPR, to drop me a tweet, it's @TomHallWIPR. You can also catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, Dr. Lena Wen joins me. On Thursday, she will leave her post as the Health Commissioner of Baltimore to become the president of Planned Parenthood. We'll talk with Dr. Wen about her tenure as Baltimore's top doc and her priorities as she takes over the country's largest organization dedicated to reproductive health. Plus, veteran political journalist and author John Judas joins me here in Studio A for a conversation about the rise of nationalism as a political movement, both here and abroad. In his latest book, Judas outlines how the financial collapse a decade ago, the influx of asylum seekers from the Middle East and North Africa, and China's ever-growing economic prominence has led to the rise of anti-immigration, anti-globalization, and xenophobic far-right political parties across the West. The book is called The Nationalist Revival. John Judas is also my guest tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is the activist and educator DeRay McKesson. We're talking about his new book, On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. You are welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR, and you can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. So you ran for mayor in the last election in the primary. It was a very crowded primary. And by my reckoning, and I talked to almost everybody running in that race, your campaign was the one that was characterized by the most ideas. And there are the ideas for change, the ideas for what would have been a McKesson administration were premised in what was successful in a lot of other places. You have clearly done a really thorough study of policing and health issues and poverty, crime, opioid addiction, etc. I wonder, have any of those ideas, but have you been approached by anybody in the Pew administration since the election, the primary, which is now a couple of years ago, about implementing any of those ideas? I mean, does that just sort of just fall? Does that just stop the minute the campaign's over?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I haven't. You know, there's some, you know, I'm really proud of, and he's not my city councilman, but Brandon Scott is one of the few people on the council who consistently, like, sort of pushes, especially around the police and criminal justice, in ways that make a lot of sense. And then Bill Ferguson in the state Senate, always proud of him, also not my senator, but those are two people that, like, sometimes I reach out to just, like, think about ideas with, because they continue to be really progressive in the way they push the city government.
You have done a lot of work about police-involved shootings and killings of Americans. You were among the first to have a database. The Washington Post followed up with that. The Guardian has also been keeping a database of people killed. Has that, by police, the number of victims, I mean, Wesley Lowery, who puts this together for the Washington Post, just wrote at the end of August about how many homicides and shootings that are non-fatal go unsolved.
Yep.
So on the one hand, there's this tension between over-policing, and then on the other hand, there's a tension about under-policing, because clearly it's some minuscule number, 30-something percent of these crimes nationally as well as here in Baltimore, are actually being solved. People don't know who the murderers are of these victims, who are largely black men.
Or it's a question of, like, is policing the answer, right? That, like, you think about in Baltimore, $500 million, a clearance rate that's really low, whole division just indicted by the FBI, DOJ comes in and is like, pattern and practice of civil rights violations. It's like, what actually is the return on the investment? Like, I don't, you know, if this was a business, it would be like, you know, we shut it down if this much money. So the question, so when you look at that data around solving, it's like, maybe you actually, the institution just isn't designed to do that sort of work. So that came, their study came out of sort of this book that was really popular called Ghetto Side, that sort of put the first highlighting on the clearance rates as being like a big marker of trust in communities. That, like, why would people trust the police if, like, they can't even find people murder people? It leads to a bigger question though about, like, is this even the solution? You think about, for 2,000 years, we slit people's wrists and called it healthcare. We literally, like, drain their blood, and we're like, oh, it's draining out the impurities. It's like, no, you're actually just killing them, right? That, like, you're like, their blood pressure went down. It's like, well, yes, their blood pressure went down because there is no blood. And, like, that, there's this moment now about, like, is this the right solution? So, like, do you need a gun to get a cat out of a tree? No. Do you need a gun to, like, help a person switch their tire when they're on the side of the road? Like, I'm not really sure you do. And, like, and again, in the city, we have crimes of addiction and crimes of poverty. And, like, policing isn't solving addiction, right? Policing isn't solving poverty. Some of our issues is, like, how do we actually deal with those things so that we don't think about, like, we don't think about a response to this as, like, the best solution. So, like, in the same thing, you know, I was a teacher. I taught sixth grade math. And, like, imagine if I built a classroom that, like, every time somebody misbehaved, all I did was, like, give out punishments. Like, that was, like, the only way I did it. No, like, my responsibility was to create a classroom that, like, fostered your engagement in such a way that I could mitigate, like, the misbehavior.
So yeah, you need a lot more arrows in the quiver than just punishment.
Yeah, just, like, sending kids a timeout every day is just not the answer. Like, anybody who has a kid or has taught knows that that's just, like, not, you know, could you imagine if all you did was take things away from people and you're like, why aren't the kids behaving better? Because it's like, you haven't created a culture where, like, that is prized and valued. And, like, that's the problem here.
What is it going to then require for the paradigm to shift to You know, there's a number of terms that people use it. What's it, restoration or restorative practice as opposed to, you know, punitive practice. I mean, the mayor, with the suggestion of the state troopers or the city council's acceptance of mandatory minimums as a, you know, as
which is wild because we know that mandatory minimums don't work. Like all the data says it doesn't work.
And that is, I think, a knee-jerk reaction to doing something now. While the longer term things, which to the mayor's credit, she mentions quite frequently, the holistic approach of addressing issues of crime and or poverty and joblessness and addiction. But that those are long term things. Those are generational things. In terms of how people need to respond now, what's your suggestion for the first immediate steps that should be taken, could be taken?
So two things. One is when we think about some of the policing stuff, it's like we created the first ever database about police union contracts and use of force policies in the country. And some of that work is structural. That one of the reasons why the police are able to do sort of whatever they want is that the structure almost guarantees that they won't be held accountable. So in Maryland, for instance, there's a law. I don't know if you obviously remember that last video that went viral of the officer slapping the guy on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. And in Maryland, the law says that you can file an anonymous complaint against an officer for everything except brutality. And you're like, that just doesn't even make sense, right? In California, there's a law that says that any investigation of an officer that lasts more than a year can never result in discipline, regardless of the outcome. In Cleveland, they destroy police officer disciplinary records every 2 years. It just like doesn't, none of that makes sense. So some of that is structural, and like we can do that in one. You think about in Maryland, the General Assembly could change that over, like they could do it quickly, and like it doesn't have to be forever. And then I push you on some of the like, it's a generational thing. Is that like, I remember being a youth organizer when I was 15 and people told me that then they were like, you know what are we gonna do about addiction? It'll take forever. And it's like, you know, if they could rewrite the tax code on the back of scrap paper and paper towels and the biggest rewrite of the tax code in generations, they did it like in a week, then like we could actually figure this stuff out too. So you think about like, what if the state, what if we figured out how to get resources from the state, which had a surplus, by the way, to like create more access and beds in the city around addiction? Like those are, we should be having these public fights about the biggest version of the idea. And like, we're just not doing that. So if the short term thing is like methadone clinics and like 10 treatment beds in the city, then like we've nailed that. But like, we got to dream bigger. So I think that's a part of it. I think that with the school system, there is a teacher shortage. Like people aren't choosing to be teachers in ways that they were. And I say that as somebody who I was in charge of hiring the teachers, I think that's a part of it. And then, like I said, not only finding people jobs, like basic jobs, like just having a job, but putting people on a career path.
The book is called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope by DeRay McKesson. He's my guest here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday at WYPR.org. Our Twitter handle at Midday WYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Daniel in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with DeRay McKesson.
Hello?
Hi. You're on the air, sir. What's on your mind?
Well, I am just wondering, after the events concerning the Kavanaugh appointment and the success of that this week, it would be like the literary term of the willing suspension of disbelief to believe that there can be any hope that anything good can ever happen. And thinking about not just the Supreme Court level, but all the federal judgeships that have been, all the Trump appointees that have been pushed through by McConnell and the Senate, and all the cases that can be brought against any positive action in the future.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Daniel. You know, after the Kavanaugh hearings and the eventual confirmation of this very controversial figure, it is easy for people, for the air to go out of a lot of sails, for people to feel just hopeless, feeling that, you know, they are feckless in their attempts to counter this. On the other hand, Mr. Trump ran on doing exactly what he did. I mean, the people who voted for him are more than happy about the outcome because they voted for specifically that outcome. How do you respond to the hopelessness that a lot of folks on the left are feeling in this week in particular?
Yeah, I'm reminded that the Republicans have been playing the long game for a long time around these issues. So about stacking state legislatures, making sure they elect governors, and then putting the conditions in place that they could even run through a nominee like this. You know, what makes me hopeful is that the numbers are actually on our side. So when we think about the work ahead, it's not how do we find the people who believe what we believe. They're already out there. That we won the popular vote by droves, right? It wasn't a matter of like numbers. The question becomes like, how do we motivate them and organize them? So when I think about young people right now, it's like one of the things that the Trump election taught us was that people aren't just motivated by voting against something. They want to vote for something. And how do we like build a structure that says like, okay, when you go out to vote, like you're voting for this, you're voting for that. Not like if you don't believe, if you know, there are a lot of people who do that, like if you love America, you vote. If you care, you'll vote. If you, and like shaming people into voting is just like a bad strategy. I think that doesn't work for young people. But I do think that people are motivated. So you think about even the Van Dyke trial in Chicago, where Laquan McDonald got shot 16 times and that officer got convicted, which is a huge win, is that for so many people, they were watching that and like, there's no reason to believe the system's gonna work in our favor, but it did this time, right? And like, that energized a lot of people to be like, oh, we can actually change some of this stuff. And I'm hopeful about those things.
Matt from Catonsville sends an email and says, why not allow the state police to patrol the streets of Baltimore? We have some of the most dangerous traffic in the country. And why should the state police not perform at least basic traffic patrols in Baltimore City, like literally every other municipality in Maryland? Furthermore, much of the illegal activities takes place by drivers on the roads, moving drugs, human trafficking, DUI, and Baltimore City police have been unable to adequately address this issue while city taxpayers already pay the salary of the state police. So why not let them in?
Well, because the thing is that like it's not like city police are just letting people violate traffic laws at like willy-nilly. What you'd be advocating for is some version of stop and frisk that like, you know, if you believe, as you wrote, that most of the drug trade is in cars and that we should just have state troopers like put up checkpoints, like that just is a, you know, I don't support any plan that is like stop and frisk, whether it's in person or whether it's in cars. And what we know from like a, not even like an emotional space, but from a data space, is that just like dumping more policing communities actually has no impact on safety. It just like does it. There's no place in the country where we've seen that happen. New York City is actually a case.
Particularly given the levels of distrust that exist among people of color in the communities and the police.
Yeah, it just shifts the drug trade. It doesn't stop it. And New York City is like a fascinating case study. And like they, for the first time, had a decrease in arrests and a decrease in crimes. Like it would, you know, people often think that like, you know, you arrest all these people and then and crime goes down. And, you know, this email, it's like if you lived in Baltimore when O'Malley was mayor, you know, we actually already tried this. He arrested a ton of people. Zero tolerance was a policy. And like, here we are again, right? It might delay the issues for a while, but like they still come back. So that it actually isn't a solution. The same thing with mandatory minimums. The city council passed a mandatory minimum bill, and any research that you can look at shows that mandatory minimums literally has no impact on crime decreasing. It doesn't. What it does do really well is lock people up. And for some people, locking people up makes them feel safer. It does. They don't want to say that out loud, but you arrest 10 more people and that like feels like safety to them, even if it like has no impact on the actual numbers.
2,827 homicides in Baltimore from 2007 to 2017. But the number of arrests here in Baltimore also gone down. But we're talking about a 35% clearance rate. So why is it in New York they can have fewer arrests and fewer murders? The murder rate per 100,000 is about 6 the last I checked. In New York, it's 58 here in Baltimore, 9 times higher than in New York. The mayor and others will tell me, it's because of the wealth in New York. There's just so much more money in New York or in Boston and some of these other communities where people try to draw parallels. Do you buy that argument that because of the tax base and because there's just more money on the Upper East Side of Manhattan than there is, even in the richest neighborhoods in Baltimore, that we are not positioned in the same way to address it as successfully as these other places?
No, I think that they have I know that the nonprofits, the political leaders all came together a couple decades ago to put together a plan, and like, you know, Baltimore just lacked a plan for a very long time. The second thing is that, like, I worry about this narrative of just, like, more wealth. I taught in the biggest project community in the country in East New York, Brooklyn, and there was not a lot of wealth there, and it still was, like, a more safe than a lot of other neighborhoods, right? Is that, again, if we know that most of the crimes that happen are crimes of addiction and crimes of poverty, it's like people figured out that they need to deal with those two issues, and then the other stuff will follow. And, like, I think that we've just not made that commitment in a substantive way.
DeRay McKesson is an activist who has worked with the Black Lives Matter movement from its early days. He hosts the podcast Pod Save the People. His new book is called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. We'll have more with DeRay McKesson when Midday returns after a quick break. Our number 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Before we take a break on Mondays every week here on Midday, it is our practice to read the names of the people who have lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 241 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Last week, 14 men and one woman were the victims of homicide in the city, including a 44-year-old man who has yet to be identified by police. The woman was Fanny Machado. She was 28 years old. The men were Lawrence Shields, age 35, Donald Lee Jackson, age 46, Thomas Hamilton, age 27, Abdulie Jallo, age 24, Randall Finney, age 32, Darrell Williamson, age 27, Philip Holloway, age 30, Garfield Leon Jr., age 30, Travis Agard, age 41, Jason Reuben Haynes, age 41, Lawrence Price, age 73, Harry Reckline, age 53, and Andrew Omar Allen. He was 18 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, DeRay McKesson is my guest this hour. The Baltimore native came to prominence during the protests that followed the death of 18-year-old Michael Brown Jr. at the hands of police in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. He is an activist, community organizer, and a former educator and education administrator. He ran for mayor of Baltimore City in 2016. He hosts a really good podcast called Pod Save the People. His book is called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. It was released last month. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. You can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, DeRay, you talk about the two ways that racism is manifested. One is through white supremacy, and the other is through anti-blackness. What's the distinction?
Yeah, just trying to give language to people. We've known this for a while, is that white supremacy is the idea that white is better, normal, standard, and everything else is a deviation from, and that white is just always worthy. Anti-blackness is normally white people participate in white supremacy. Anti-blackness is a set of beliefs that are literally just anti-black. So you think about some people of color who participate in things that shame black people for poverty, that people want to have like lighter skin. Those sort of things are like the subset of things that are anti-blackness, and that we're trying to make sure that we have policies and practices and laws that do neither.
You say that I now believe that the foundation of white supremacy rests in a preoccupation with dominance at the expense of others, and that the self-interest and economic benefits are a result, not the reason or the cause. Does that represent an evolution in your understanding of white supremacy? I mean, are we changing our take on what it actually, on fundamentally what it means?
Yeah, just like, you know, just trying to flesh out the, like, how did we get here, is that one of the interesting things about whiteness is this, the way it participates in myths of self-mastery and self-making. So you think about the wealth gap. It's like white people didn't earn wealth in the country. Is that, like, there were hordes of people of color who were not paid for any labor. White people were literally given, like, free houses, or, like, houses with very low interest rates on loans, like, almost negligible. Free education, like, the Howe administration created what we call the suburbs for white community. They're, like, we actually gave that to white people. White people didn't have to be, like, small business owners to get that at scale. Didn't have to, like, we gave it to them. It's only when you start to think about people of color and poor people that people are like, oh, my God, how, like, what could we possibly do? And you're like, what happens when you disenfranchise generations of people of color, like, who worked, who literally built everything that you see, and then, like, they got nothing for it, right? Like, you didn't teach them how to read and write. And people are like, wow, like, why are people of color, like, in the position they're in? It's like, they didn't actually do anything wrong to be in this position. The fact that they overcame it is actually a miracle in and of itself.
Do programs like affirmative action begin to redress that deficit, which obviously goes way back, as you say? I mean, it's historic. It's centuries old. Are there programs, because there are a bunch of white folks listening, I bet, who are going to say, wait a minute, we give plenty of stuff to black folks now who get it because of their current situation and because even of the historical situation that led to their current dilemma.
Yeah, remember, even the language of, like, giving stuff to people of color, it's like they earned it, right? That, like, families literally, I mean, like, generations of black people weren't paid for any labor. That's, like, wild. And you think about the net effect of that is that, like, so when people talk about reparations isn't a radical idea. The thought that we should acknowledge that happened and do something about it. So affirmative action is, like, one of the things that can be helpful. And again, what happened with white people is that we just did it at scale. So we've not done anything at scale for people of color. So, like, when we did redlining, we did it at scale in this country. The GI Bill was at scale for white people. The Housing Administration, like, part of redlining, systemically denying black people loans, like, that disenfranchisement at scale. But we did it for white people. Like, what we gave them was a scaled solution. We barely want to let people of color get food stamps, you know? Like, we're putting work requirements in for people to like, even benefit from basic services.
Let's go to the phones again. Andrew in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with DeRay McKesson.
Hey, sir. Thanks for having me. How are you doing today?
Good.
Yeah, I just want to thank, first of all, the guest for his years of public service and also as an educator. So thank you for your service, sir.
Thank you.
Hey, I just had a couple. I'm just a forewarning. I am a bit of an opposite perspective on a couple things that you gentlemen were talking about today. I just wanted to just briefly bring up, like, how this kind of like a generalization about how you're talking about in Baltimore. There's crimes of poverty. And what was the other?
Crimes of addiction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like, there's a terrible problem with poverty and addiction. And to be forthright honest with you, like, police officers are not equipped to solve those problems. Like, you were talking about how they're, you know, police work is not equipped. It's, as an institution, it's not able to provide the level of service that is able to solve those problems. I am not debating that at all. I think that to break down, like, the crimes of Baltimore to only crimes of addiction and only crimes of poverty is a bit generalization. Not, and I know, you know, you can't talk about everything forever on a talk show, but how, I mean, murder over the drug trade, is that a crime of poverty or is that a crime of addiction? I don't think
addiction.
It's either. I think it's people
drugs.
Being bad.
Yeah, but, like, what they're not just, like, unless you think that people literally just walking outside just shooting people just because they, like, woke up and wanted to kill somebody. So when you say even, like, over the drug trade, like why are people buying drugs? Because they're addicted to drugs, right? It's all a part of, so that comes into, again, like a crime of addiction, that if you, if there's no longer demand for drugs and you actually have changed how people participate in communities of addiction. So I agree with you that, like, you know, I don't think people are just, like, walking outside wantonly shooting people. I do think that people are participating in a legal economy because for a lot of reasons. And that we can actually do something about that, that's not mystery.
Thanks for that call, Andrew. I appreciate it. Shay gets in touch with us via Facebook, says, since many of Baltimore City students live in poverty and broken families' neighborhoods, Why don't we tear down the blighted buildings and create boarding homes for kids? They can live in a safe and pro-learning environment. It seems to me that no matter how much money we put into the school system, it's clearly not working. These kids are living in a war zone and they need help. These kids need to feel safe, fed, and nurtured.
Yeah, I'm going to push you a little bit on the language of broken families. It's like, tell me a family that's perfect. I don't know. You show me, I've been around a lot of families with a whole lot of money who have their own problems. I've been around families with very little money where there's like a lot of joy. I've been around families of all types that have people who have suffered sexual abuse, like all types of trauma, addiction. So I don't know what I worry about this labeling of like kids in Baltimore being from broken families is like a statement. I don't know what like perfect families look like. But what I will say is that like we shouldn't use any sort of reason to say that we don't invest in kids. So like, yeah, the school system is a great example of like what happens when you send somebody to the store and give them $2 and expect them to buy something that costs $200. Like, of course, they're coming back short every time. And they're coming back short not because they didn't want to do what you said, not because they like don't care, but because they actually just weren't given the resources to do it well in the first place. And that is the school system here in Baltimore. So we've never seen an adequately funded school system. So when you see on the news that kids are in classrooms with no air conditioners or kids are in schools with no working heat, it's because of the school system that literally, and I was a cabinet member sitting at this table too, like we're making decisions about like, do we fix the elevator or do we put more air conditioners in? It's like an impossible set of choices. And let me tell you that in Baltimore County and Montgomery County, they're not making choices like that. That like, we have to deal with like what happens with a really old infrastructure. And like the 21st Century Plan is a part of that. The second is that like the danger of this idea of like boarding schools or boarding, like the boarding notion is that like, I don't believe that we have to separate kids from their families for them to thrive. That like part of our commitment is like, how do we help everybody? Right. That like, you know, we should have adult literacy programs in the city for parents who never mastered reading because the school system failed them. We should do that. We should teach people how to be great parents. We should help people find great jobs, right? Like, that should be a part of our strategy, like wrapping around families instead of saying that the only way that kids can grow up safe is by being separated from them. And then to beat a dead horse is, again, addiction and poverty are two of the biggest issues we have in the city. And like, we know how to tackle them. We just don't have a plan here.
So again, I mean, I'm reading into Shay's comment here. Perhaps what he or she is thinking of is that family in which the mother is addicted. Okay, the problems of addiction, and let's pick addiction for the hypothetical family, and that mother is not doesn't have the capacity to care for those children. Is there should we scale up the efforts and the ability of the system, the government, the city, to take those children out of those situations that are at the moment not particularly
yeah, but
helpful.
Not like,
I mean,
a boarding
program. You have very personal experience with this yourself, with your
yeah,
own
but not
mom.
A boarding program. Like, we mm-hmm. can put people with other family members. My challenge is that, like, people rarely believe this when it's affluent parents addicted to opioids. Like, that is not... That's not how people like think about this. So like, if your solution for
plenty of those.
An affluent mom who's addicted to opioids is take her kids away, then like, then at least that's like logically consistent. But what people say here is that like, there's somebody addicted in the city and they're black and like, we should just strip the kids. A parent can't do anything. Like, that is actually how this rhetoric take hold.
April gets in touch via Facebook. Are you considering running against for mayor?
Oh, I don't know for mayor. You know, I believe that we have to be as organized on the inside as we are on the outside. That's why I went to go work back in the school system, is that we can't just be the people fighting and challenging the people in these positions of power. We have to be those people. You know, one of the reasons why I still live in the city is that, like, I believe that the city can be better and that the moment we put together a plan and have the right people in place, like, we'll do it. It'll work. It'll be great. And again, this whole thing about, like, there are not enough resources, it's like we had a surplus, everybody, at the state level. What we don't have is a commitment.
Just real quick, we have 15 seconds. We've talked about this before, but you talk about how people who are racist, who are engaged in denial, we have to shift the cognitive burden to them. Explain real briefly what that means.
You know, I think about even with the police. I was on a panel once with an officer, and she said to me, DeRay, it's a lot of crime out there. You saying the police should never kill somebody. And what I said to her is, like, when should the police kill your child? Like, you tell me, when is a scenario that your kid's going to make a mistake and you'd be okay for the police killing them? And she's like, I don't know. And it's like, well, I don't know either. But that's about shifting the cognitive work. So I'm not just preaching, but they're actually doing some work.
DeRay McKesson, he's a civil rights activist, a community organizer, and the host of the award-winning podcast Pod Save the People. His book is called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. Thanks, sir. See you soon.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Baltimore Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen joins me for her final appearance on the Midday Health Watch before she takes the reins of Planned Parenthood. And John Judas talks about the growing popularity of nationalist movements in North America and Europe. His latest book is called The Nationalist Revival: Trade, Immigration, and the Revolt Against Globalization. That's all coming up tomorrow. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. Online at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall, here and now, coming up after a break for news from NPR. We want to thank you for listening. Have a great day.